Remember when people said either the revolution will not be televised or the alternate? When you stop to think about it, television itself was a revolution. It certainly transformed society, changing the way we communicate and spend our time. So if you think in those terms, we've been through a few revolutions in our lifetimes. Today's guest speaks of such things tonight at Southern Oregon University as part of the campus theme of revolution. Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas speaks at 7 tonight at the Meese Auditorium at the Arts Center at SOU in Ashland. He is the author of 5 books on contemporary politics and foreign policy. In September 2011, he published a book on the past and future of nation building called Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. Jeremy Suri, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
So the topic of revolution is clearly right up your alley, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So when you think about, I mean, obviously you've covered a fair amount of, you know, geopolitical intersections, and so I imagine there's a fair amount of hot war in your discussions of revolution.
Absolutely. One of the points I make is that revolutions involve many kinds of changes, but unfortunately they often involve violence.
But obviously not exclusively about societal transformation through hot wars.
Correct.
What's in second place, I guess, is where we go then. I mean, behind armed change of society, what seems to be in second place?
Well, one of the major elements of revolution is attitude change and the ways in which people start to see issues in new ways. Attitudes are sticky. It takes a long time to get people to change the way they think. We all know that from our own personal experience as well. And what makes a period revolutionary is when long-held attitudes seem to shift and shift pretty quickly. And we've all experienced that in our own lives. I was talking with a number of colleagues here yesterday. Think about how our attitudes towards gay and lesbian activities have changed, right? That's revolutionary. That's part of the revolutions of the 1960s, I would argue. I would say one of the great successes was getting us to see homosexuality as less deviant in our society. So revolutions are often about violence and about hot wars, as you put it. They're often about major attitudinal changes around personal issues that are often difficult to change attitudes around under normal conditions.
When we talk about changing attitudes, does it seem that there's a certain level of momentum that builds up and then there's a release? Because, I mean, it took, what, the better part of 40 years to get from the Stonewall riots in Greenwich Village to states even begin to legalize same-sex marriage.
Precisely.
And then in the last 5 years, though, it seems like it's really gone
absolutely
fast.
So I think there are a number of things that happened that I try to write about. First is, just as you said so well, you get a build-up in anger, a build-up in resistance, a build-up in conflict. But second, you often tend to have material circumstances that change. People who are excluded become important economic actors, important consumers, important producers, and that, of course, makes them part of the conversation in a way they weren't before. And then something else I write about that's, I think, very important is generational change. I think it's safe to say that attitudes are very difficult to change for people once they reach a certain age. It does happen, but it's very rare. But attitudes can change quite a lot when a new generation comes of age in a new context. So those, for instance, of my generation who came of age after the late 60s, I was born in the early 1970s, many issues that seemed unthinkable for my parents in the 60s seemed normal for us in the 70s. Again, the presence of gay and lesbian individuals, civil rights. I mean, issues and attitudes towards race have changed most not because people were marching with Martin Luther King, but because a new generation came of age after Martin Luther King marched.
You're in an interesting place to talk about transformations, too, being at the University of Texas right now. I
mean, yes.
Austin, in particular, being a fairly liberal bastion in the middle of a very, very red state. But that in itself is a huge transformation. I mean, when I lived in the South 30 years ago, everybody was a Democrat, and they had been since the Civil War.
Absolutely. And in 20 years, we'll be sitting here, and there'll be Democrats again,
really?
Demographically looking at things. But your example of Austin is a really good one. It's another point that I try to make about revolutions, is that revolutions tend to occur in particular places. They tend to occur in small, concentrated areas and then fan out. And so you have the Austins, you have the Ashlands, you have the Madisons, you have the Berkeleys. Don't expect to see major transformation across a wide range of areas. You're going to see it in particular places where you have groups and material circumstances that encourage and enable that.
Well, then the groups do tend to cluster around place. Well, in the case of Madison, Wisconsin, where you lived previously to Austin, Texas, you got liberal bastions and state government and a huge state university.
Exactly right. And now a sort of a culture that attracts entrepreneurs who are interested in precisely that environment, right? People who want to live in that place.
But there's a fair amount of echo chamberness, I would think, in that sort of context then.
Well, that's one of the problems. And that's one of the reasons you see conflict and violence, which is you can create, as you say, an echo chamber around a certain set of issues. issues, and then you'll have people living right around those communities that come to see them very differently. And what also arises is a bifurcation in self-definition, which is to say people in one community define themselves as the opposite of another. So Madison, Berkeley, Ashland tend to be surrounded by communities of people who are resentful of what they see as the privileged progressivism of people living in particular areas. And so that can reinforce a reactive culture around these.
Even deeper than they might have been without the
presence?
Precisely. Okay.
Precisely. So, I mean, to give an example, right, you'll often hear people say, oh, those young people who are protesting in whatever the community is, right, well, they can only do this because they're privileged, right? If they were working class people like us, they wouldn't be able to do that. And so to take, for example, late 1960s, what you find are a lot of the police officers who were brought onto college campuses then are from working class backgrounds and have family members who served in Vietnam, and they resent the fact that these students who have student deferments, who don't have to go and serve, are protesting against the war. You'll get the same sort of discussions today when people are perhaps on a college campus protesting against our war on terror. You'll have people coming in who will say, well, I didn't have the chance to go to college. I had to go serve in the military. How dare you protest or disregard or disrespect what I've done in Afghanistan or Iraq?
How much of the politics of the 60s do you ascribe to the fact that there were just so many young people at that time?
It's a major point. It's a point actually I'll make tonight considerably. Demographics matter. It's not just that there were so many young people. It's that there were so many new college opportunities for them. The 1950s and 60s are in many ways the golden age for American universities. They're expanding. There are jobs for faculty everywhere. College is affordable for almost everyone in states like Wisconsin, perhaps in Oregon. I don't know the history here as well. It's almost free for people to go.
It was pretty close.
Yeah, and so it's accessible, and you have all of these individuals, young people coming of age in college. What it does is it creates a population that has the two attributes that are most necessary to be involved with protest activities. They have time, and they have resources.
Much more to talk about. Jeremy Suri on the other side of a break. We're talking about revolutions. Revolution is the campus theme at Southern Oregon University this year. He'll be speaking about revolution, public opinion, and power, historical lessons for the future, tonight at 7 at the Mies Auditorium at the Arts Center at Southern Oregon University. Back to resume our discussion with Jeremy Suri, and you can join it as well on the other side of the break in a minute 5. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas. He is officially the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy. And he is at the Southern Oregon University campus as part of the campus theme of revolutions. He's the final major speaker in the series. He'll talk about revolution, public opinion, and power, historical lessons for the future, tonight at 7 at the Mies Auditorium in Ashland. You can join us here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm curious about the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor. He was the football coach.
He was indeed. Yes, and so he helped to raise money for the chair that they used to hire me.
So you don't just have to study football history.
No, I don't have to. I get to go to some of the games, but hopefully we'll start winning some games. You know, we tend to produce great quarterbacks in Texas, and then they go play somewhere else.
They do indeed. Yeah, Colt McCoy and all the other guys.
That's exactly right.
I was reading something you wrote. Like other historians, I treat power as contingent, context dependent, and often quite elusive. That gives a real feeling of, you know it when you got it, and you're not so sure when you don't.
Absolutely. Well, there's something slippery about power. Power is not really about titles, and power really isn't about having lots of guns and lots of money. Power is about getting people to do things. And that changes with different circumstances. So take, for instance, what we were just talking about, the civil rights movement. For a long time in the 1950s, it seemed as if it was impossible to get anything done on those issues. And then very quickly, because of an elaborate strategy and a new generation of actors in American society, it became very difficult to resist certain elements of that. We're living now through a period when it seems very difficult to resist a backlash against many of these issues. That's not because the people on the backlash side have more weapons. It's because they've been able to turn the rhetoric and the expectations of our society in a different direction. That's what power is really about, expectations and getting people to assume they have to do certain things they might not have to do.
So the rhetoric and the expectations, I mean, I imagine media plays a major part in this, and in just the messages delivered to media in the first place.
Absolutely. Media plays a very important role. Individual leaders play a very important role, and institutions matter. So one of the reasons universities are so important to understanding American society is they provide an institutional framework for a lot of these ideas to be worked out. And it's not just ideas on the left. Universities also produce ideas on the right. People tend to only talk about this in one direction. Our neoconservative movement comes out of universities just as much as a sort of new left movement came out of universities.
There was a column you wrote in December, The Revolution in Education in America, which was about this same sort of thing.
Absolutely. I think one of the best investments we've made over time is not just putting money into higher education because it's important for people to learn, but using higher education as a laboratory for innovation. One of the reasons we stay ahead of the Chinese is because we have free spaces where people come together, diverse people, to actually think about issues. And these are not just issues of technological change, issues of social change. Every major social movement in the United States in the 20th century had a connection to universities.
But then we get into the situation which you referenced and have referenced in your work a bit, that the complaint is that it tends to be a very left-wing kind of thing, that all the free thinking leads to people who are thinking in generally one direction. And you're making the case that it's both directions.
It's both directions. I mean, universities tend to be dominated by people who like to live in the world of ideas and like to question authority. So that looks like it's a little left of center, but it really isn't. What it is called innovation. It's called questioning and rethinking assumptions we hold.
Will you make the same charge for the media, for example? Because honestly, throughout a career as a journalist, it seems like the people who question authority, therefore, will be journalists, and the people who question authority are often identified as liberal.
Well, so I think that's a mischaracterization. I think what it is to say is they carry an attitude, a personality, that might be less deferential to authority than others. And so if you want to code conservative as being someone who follows authority, okay, people in the media and people in the academic world tend to be less believing in authority. But on the other hand, their political preferences are not necessarily left or right. There are a huge number of journalists who are highly patriotic, right? You've met many of these individuals, right? One of the problems we have is that journalists, I think, quite legitimately feel a desire to rally around the flag when an event like 9/11 occurs. They're not leftists. They're patriotic, red-blooded Americans, right? But they are more willing to question authority than perhaps the average citizen who's not in the media, someone who works in the corporate world or somewhere else. So I think there are attitude differences, but we miscode them politically when we call them left or right.
Wow. So many different ways we could go here. It seems like from your work, you're often hoping that we learn from what has gone before.
I really hope so. It's why we study history, Jeffrey.
So do we learn from revolutions? I mean, do we learn the lessons of previous movements and mistakes and things that went well, too?
Well, the way history works is what Hegel said. And we could use fancy terms like dialectical materialism and stuff. We can avoid that because we're Americans. We don't have to sound like Germans. History is about two steps forward, one step back. And so we learn and we do make progress, but then we often step back because conditions lead us to step back or we get buyer's remorse on what we've done. So our society will not return to Jim Crow, but I would argue that we were a more racially inclusive society 10 years ago than we are today. So we've made a little bit of a step back, and we'll continue to learn from those various lessons as such. So we learn from the civil rights movement, but what happens is the lessons are learned in many different ways and used in many different ways.
How are we less racially inclusive now?
I think if you look, for example, at the way police operate with regard to African-American males, if you look at our continued high incarceration rates, there are more African-American males in prison than in college today. And you look at certain attitudes that are voiced, particularly in the West and in the South in our country, things that would not be accepted before. We've made enormous progress with an African-American president, but also there's enormous racial opposition to him as well as policy opposition.
So you're one of many people who sees it as at least partly based on the color of his skin.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably in the 10 to 20% of what the opposition is constituted of, but I think it enables the opposition. And I think there are a lot of people who would be opposed to him anyway, but feel a visceral opposition because they have trouble seeing a black man as president. Let me put this as clearly as I can. I think that for many people, it's easier to imagine voting for a black man than it is to see one as the president of your country. Those are two different things. And this is something that Hillary Clinton will have to deal with as well. Someone running for office is not actually in that position of authority yet.
This is kind of the generic ballot question, isn't it? I will vote for any person of this class over the guys in this party that I know.
Exactly.
But then when you're faced with an actual person who fits that category, the African-American man or the woman running for president, then it's like, well, not her.
Exactly.
Or not him.
Exactly. Because it's hard to imagine that. It's hard to see oneself in that position. And that's a learning experience. We as historians should not be surprised. This would be one of the lessons from the past, right? That this kind of change is slow, even when we think it's happening fast before our eyes.
In a sense, do things like public opinion polls help historians at all, or do they just muddy the waters just a bit as time goes on, depending on their quality? Because we can certainly get a sense of what the American people in particular, because you know we live here and that's where most of the polls are. but we can get a sense of what they're thinking on a very regular basis. But then again, what happens, what action is taken based upon those opinions can often differ greatly.
I think public opinion polls have to be used very carefully. We as historians, what we do is we collect as much evidence as we can. We rummage through your attic. We collect all the material, and then we try to assess it and critically evaluate it. So anyone who reads public opinion polls and says, Gallup said 80% of Americans believe this, they clearly believe that, that is a simplistic and distorted way of viewing things. But public opinion polls are helpful, and just what you said, Jeffrey, tracing trends. So, for instance, we've used them in looking at American opinions on war. And what you find looking at public opinion polls, a couple of historical lessons, that enthusiasm for war dies pretty quickly with Americans. Americans don't remain enthusiastic for war very long, but opposition to war takes a long time to grow. So there never were a majority of Americans who opposed the Vietnam War. There were a majority of Americans who were dissatisfied, but not a majority who ever said, let's get out. And so this is where polls can help us, right? Americans develop anger, frustration with a long-going war if it's in Iraq or if it's in Vietnam, but they don't very quickly or decisively move against the war. They instead criticize the leaders who they think are mismanaging the war.
That's a good use of scalpel there to divide up the I don't like what's going on versus from I want us out.
Exactly.
There's a difference.
Exactly. And that's where polls can help us in, as you said, having that scalpel.
Jeremy Suri is our guest, history professor at the University of Texas, the Mac Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy.
That's only with my wife. It's public apology.
At the University of Texas at Austin. He'll be speaking at the Southern Oregon University campus tonight at 7 at the Meese Auditorium. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Mark in Reading, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I have a question and a comment. My question is, how much do you think the 1% or perhaps the 0.1% of the wealthiest people in the country, how much power do they have over our country? And my comment is that in the 60s in Oregon, one could go to Oregon State University for $100 a term if one were a resident of the state of Oregon.
Yes. All right. So, yes, another way in which higher education has changed. Mark, thanks for those.
So great questions, Mark. I do think the very wealthy in our society, the hyper-wealthy, have historically tried to influence our politics and have now probably more influence than they've had in about 40 years over our politics. And it's for a very simple reason. It's the money that goes into campaigning. It's the way in which a small group of very, very wealthy people can keep candidates in the race and support certain issues. And that's always been the case. Money has always been part of American politics. But over the last 10 to 15 years, it's become worse than it had been in about half a century, in part because of the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United and in part because of various other things and the accumulation of wealth that have occurred. So I think this is a real issue, and I will tell you just personally, as someone who at a public policy school tries to encourage a lot of young people to go into politics, it's the biggest barrier for young people. Young, smart people who want to go into politics are dissuaded because they don't have a lot of money and they don't want to spend all their time raising money.
All things being equal, though, I mean, if it were not such an awash in money kind of proposition, they didn't have to spend all their time on the phone seeking contributions, as people in office do these days, would it appeal to them more? Because there's also that stigma of like, geez, only the weirdos go into politics.
Well, there is that, right. And there is the way your name gets dragged through the mud and your mother and wife and brother and everyone will be destroyed in the process. But I do think the money is the biggest barrier because many of them who are going to a public policy school are political junkies already, and they like that world. But what leads them to decide, you know, maybe I'll go work as a consultant, or maybe I'll go into journalism instead of going into politics, is because they say, look, the people who are running against me who are less qualified, well, they happen to know someone really wealthy, and they're going to have a leg up on me, and I'm not going to be able to compete with that. And so the money, I think, is for those who are already political junkies and would add something to the process, it's discouraging for them. I want to say something else also about the OSU tuition of $100 per term. This is a really important point. A very high proportion of the economic leaders of our society today, very, very high proportion, went to public universities and they were able to go for free in the 1960s. The story I've seen with many, many alumni in many parts of the country, wealthy alumni, is they arrived at Madison or Austin or Eugene with only the money in their pockets, and they worked as a waiter and a bartender to pay themselves through school. You can't do that today. The problem is those individuals now oppose the use of public money for universities, and that's a real problem. I don't think universities should be free. They should be affordable to anyone who's qualified to go.
And that was a real revolution in itself. I mean, the fact that we were cranking out that many smart people in mid-20th century America.
Absolutely. It's between 1860 and 1960, it's something unique about America. It begins with the Morrill Land Grant in 1862, which creates the land grant public university system, including many of our great universities.
Including Oregon State.
Including Oregon State. And the idea for Oregon State and others, it's Lincoln's idea, is that any poor man from the frontier, like Lincoln, and later any poor woman, and hopefully anyone, who is qualified should be able to go and get an education. And we do that on a range and a scale no other country does between 1860 and 1960. It makes our society what it is, Jeffrey.
And yet we're in danger of backsliding from that, do you think, because of the cost of higher education?
It's because of the cost of higher education. It's because people don't recognize the value in it anymore. And I think it's also because we've been distracted and we're putting our money into other things. It's the opportunity cost of paying to put people in prison rather than educating them. It's the opportunity cost of paying for elderly health care than it is for young people. We invest today $4 to $5 more per person if you're above 60 than if you're under 20. In terms of public money. That makes no sense at all. We did the opposite in the 1950s. So we had a much better investment strategy then. But, of course, there were fewer older people.
Well, as I was going to say, the demographics really dictate this.
Well, but
this
is a problem. So elderly people, and I love them. I have grandparents. I love elderly people. I'm not dissing them. But they vote in large numbers, and they vote to protect their benefits regardless of what party they're in. And there's an opportunity cost. There's a fixed amount of money in our society, right? Hopefully that budget continues to grow, but there still are opportunity costs and more money for one group versus another. So our money's going to health and it's going to prisons. It's not really defense. I mean, we probably spend too much on defense, but it's a small part of the budget. It's health, largely for the elderly, and it is prisons. And that's taking money away from OSU and Oregon State and South Southern Oregon.
Let's take more calls. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with historian Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas.
Good morning, Dr. Suri.
Good morning.
I spend a lot of time in the community and take the pulse here in Josephine County. And of course, we have the whole political spectrum, and we have the whole social spectrum at work. However, I'm seeing an increasing level of dissatisfaction with government and a increasing level of dissatisfaction with the with all of the political parties. To develop a proper revolution and a proper revolt, you have to develop cross-cutting alliances. And I'm seeing this dissatisfaction again across all segments of the population here, you know, or at least some segments here. Take off your historian's hat for a minute and put on a prognosticator's hat and tell us what you think would cause a revolt and what form it would take.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul.
Great question, Paul. Well, I think you've laid out many of the circumstances that would lead us, Paul, to believe that a major revolution of one kind or another, a major shift in our politics is going to happen. As you said, there's widespread dissatisfaction across areas, and there are large numbers of people who felt themselves well-served by the process who don't feel well-served by the process now. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to see new organizations formed, maybe at the local level. Maybe the Tea Party, for better or for worse, is one version of this. And you're going to also see new people getting mobilized to be involved around issues that they weren't involved around before. And I think the real opportunity here, connecting to our prior discussion, Paul, is that young people who have largely been disengaged from the process will be motivated to get re-involved with the process and become actors connected to other cross-cutting alliances. So an alliance I would see, for example, would be an alliance that really wants to see a rethinking of how we handle education policy in our society. No Child Left Behind didn't work, but neither did what existed before that. Right? How are we using our money to best provide educational opportunities for people? Another area, I think, is going to be in thinking about how we deal with environmental issues. We all face, regardless of what we precisely believe, we all see the environment creating challenges for us in terms of business and personal livelihoods, and our politics are not addressing that either. So I can imagine large numbers of existing political actors and new actors to the process getting involved around these issues. One last point, Paul. Revolutions always involve new people becoming political actors. And I think our young people who largely don't vote will play an important role going forward.
A couple things here. First of all, it seems like we've got people from both ends of the political spectrum in Jackson and Josephine counties in the election a year ago to go for bans on GMO crops. Mm-hmm. They both voted mm-hmm. for those. That's one thing. The other one is that, I mean, after the rise of the Tea Party, it looked like Occupy movement was going to be
right.
perhaps the left's answer to it, and yet it didn't seem to gain any political strength that lasted into the following election.
Right, and I think that was predictable, and I was someone who supported the Occupy movement, I'll confess, but it was predictable because the members of the movement, at least those I talked to, and I talked to a lot of them in New York and in Austin, they didn't want to become political. They wanted to be anti-political. Hmm. And my view was, this is not an I told you so moment, but my view was, you make change by being part of the political process. If you want your movement to do something, you've got to get people elected to office and start locally.
Much more to talk about with Jeremy Siri from the University of Texas. We've got a couple of phone lines open. If you'd like to join us on the other side of the break, we will take one now. He speaks tonight at 7 at the Mies Auditorium at the Center for the Visual Arts on the Southern Oregon University campus on revolution, public opinion, and power, historical lessons for the future. But we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Siri and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about a lot of things in the general context of revolutions, the hot kind and the not. There can be transformations of society that don't necessarily involve people unsheathing guns and other weapons and putting them to use. Jeremy Siri is a bit of an expert on those. He's a historian at the University of Texas, the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy at UT Austin. He is at Southern Oregon University to speak tonight on revolution, public opinion, and power. And you can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. More calls to take. Here's Mike in our Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good day, Mr. Siri. I wanted to make a quick comment about something you said earlier. I think the American political system is based on the fact that we have a peaceful revolution through voting every few years. And earlier you made a comment equating liberalism with not being patriotic. And I think that statement betrays a blind spot, and that we equate any particular political bent with patriotism. Liberals can be patriotic, conservatives can be patriotic, and I think it's very, very important that both sides of that fence recognize that the other side is equally patriotic. Thank you for your time, and I'll take my comment off the air.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Excellent, Mike. Thank you for your clarification and your comment. I completely agree, and I've written this and argued this considerably. Let me underline your point about how liberals can be patriotic, just as conservatives can be patriotic. There is nothing more American. There's nothing more normal in American history than for people to protest against war. We've only had one war in our history, in our long history of many, many wars, where there really wasn't significant public opposition, and that was World War II. Every war that we've faced has had opposition on the left and the right. So there is nothing unpatriotic about supporting war. In fact, it's the highest call to patriotism, to stand up for democracy at a time of militarism. And liberals are as patriotic historically as conservatives. In fact, in the 20th century, liberal presidents have been more responsible for warfare than conservative presidents. So,
Careful, you're going to have a Bob Dole moment. Democratic warrior. <for that. laughs>
Exactly. Yes, that's a good one. I hadn't thought about that in a while. So I agree with you, Mike, 100%. The point I was simply making is that we have stereotypes about left and right that don't match up with the institutions we associate with them with. Most people in the academy, most people in the journalistic world are not left-wing revolutionaries, nor are they right-wing fascists. They tend to be moderates, actually, and with a smattering of other views.
But, you know, it's interesting to think about patriotism in the terms of some of the symbols of patriotism,
yes.
The flag pins,
mm-hmm.
and the use of the flag. And I wonder how much of the way that people will identify their patriotism is in reaction to another's. So much of our political discourse these days is practically ODD, oppositional defiant mm-hmm. disorder, where, you know, mm-hmm. well, if he's wrapping himself in the flag, I want nothing to do with that flag. I love my country, but not the way he does.
Right. Oh, I think that's right. And I think this is, just as you said, this is a phenomenon of a two-party system where you have one side trying to define itself as not the other side. And so you'll have that in this next election, too. The Republicans are all running as not Obama, right? And Hillary's going to run as a little bit of Obama, but a little bit not of Obama at the same time. But I think that reveals less about deeper views. What is significant in American history is that we're a very young country, but yet we have a remarkably patriotic population across areas. But patriotism does not mean uncritical. It means love of country. And Americans do love their countries, even those who are critical of their country.
Tom in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Suri.
Hello, Jeffrey. I want to thank you for your show. It's a great experience to listen to your comments. And
thank you.
Yes. I had a comment and I had a question. Comment is, after 25 years as a professor in East Coast and West Coast universities, I can't agree with the position that the academy is not highly liberal. It's not my experience. So that's just a comment. The question is regarding higher education and the funding thereof. In addressing that, only one side of that issue was addressed, and that's public support. But I wonder if your guest could speak to the other side, which is the increase in salaries and expenses associated with the education.
Ah, so the cost.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, Tom, thank you for your call. You clearly are an expert on these issues as well and have lived them at many universities. So on the cost issue, salaries, I think the issue is that universities spend a lot of money on things that they probably shouldn't spend money on, things that differ from their actual educational mission. And there are a lot of big elephants in the room when we talk about that. One is athletics, right? Another one is fancy buildings. Another one is all the student services that are provided. There's now an arms race to provide the nicest climbing walls to the top students who want to go to different places. So there's a lot of money that's diverted and spent on the wrong things. And sometimes this is also about salaries, salaries for administrators, salaries for some faculty who are probably paid too much and do too little. But it's hard to generalize on the salary issue because there also are a lot of very, very hardworking professors, many of whom are my former PhD students who now teach at various places, some of whom teach at Southern Oregon University, who are quite frankly underpaid for the amount of work they do. So I don't want to sit here and say that we've overpaid professors. I think what we've had develop in the university system is exactly what happens in our society at large. There is too much money flowing to too many places without enough focus on whether the money is serving the mission of the institution. I think universities should pay their professors just as high school should pay their teachers as much as possible to do the best possible job, full stop.
Another question here from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Suri.
Steve? I fought the war in Vietnam in the streets of Portland and Eugene. I got tear gas in Portland, pepper gas in Eugene, but I was still out there. And looking around, I had hundreds, if not thousands, of people marching with me. And now we have the war in Iraq, and we didn't see anything near the protests we had in Vietnam. I'm wondering if that's because people don't have their butts on the line. They're not being faced with conscription going to the front lines, getting shot at, maybe getting killed. And so they could say, well, it doesn't really matter to me.
Yes, Steve. First of all, thank you for sharing your experiences with us. But I think you, in part, answered your question very astutely. The end of the draft, the creation of an all-volunteer military in the early 1970s, as you know, changes the dynamic. So young people, particularly those who come from upwardly mobile families, are unlikely to serve, or less likely to serve, I should say, than those who come from less upwardly mobile families, and therefore feel less affected. So war is separated from our lives. But there's a deeper issue, too. Too many young people today, I see this with my students, and the evidence, the sociological evidence supports this, too many young people are professionalized too young in their lives. They're told from the time they're even in middle school, here are the 17 steps you need to follow to get into the best university, and then get into the best graduate school, and then get the best job. And they are so driven to stay on that track to success that their parents are encouraging them to stay on, that getting politically involved, doing anything risky, seems too dangerous. And so they're discouraged. That explains why we've seen a large-scale migration, and Tom, who was on before, I'm sure knows about this too, of people who used to major in literature and humanities toward more technical fields of study. I just spoke to the honor students majoring in business at the University of Texas a few weeks ago, and I asked them, why do you major in business? And none of them said because they loved the idea of business, it's because they thought they were going to make more money graduating in business.
So the result is we're not just cranking out people who are smart in a broad range of areas anymore. I mean, they are smart.
Of course. Oh, yeah, they are.
But they are more focused on the kind of field they expect to end up in.
Absolutely. I would say this, especially at our top universities, students are working harder than ever before, and they are smarter than ever before. It's more competitive. But they are more professionally provincialized early on to be worker bees rather than thinkers in the way someone like Steve was going out and marching in the 1960s. They are risk averse.
Chris and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Suri.
Hi. It seems to me you haven't said anything yet about how revolution is suppressed by, like, security state power holders. Like, I'm thinking in my lifetime how JFK and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Robert F. Kennedy, I believe, and I go with the Project Unspeakable line, that they were assassinated by the security state because they were charismatic populists who were a threat to the, you know, status quo. And I think the same thing happened to in the Black Panther movement and somewhat in the Occupy movement, not to specific personalities, but just how the security state came down really hard on the participants.
I think, Chris, you have a point. Certainly, revolutions spark backlashes, and there are organized interests that in various ways seek to undermine revolutionary change. And sometimes that involves direct use of violence. That's part of what we're seeing in many of our inner cities today. That's part of what was going on in Baltimore, part of what was going on in Ferguson, Missouri. So we shouldn't get that wrong. It's exactly what you're talking about. But it happens in other ways, too, the ways different behavior is incentivized and disincentivized. So to come back to the prior discussion, young people are frightened about doing anything revolutionary because they feel they're going to be penalized by people later on. They feel that their prospective employers will hold this against them. And that's a form of suppression in the way you're talking about. It doesn't just have to come from the security state, though it sometimes does. It comes from various other powerful parts of our society.
Another call here from Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Suri.
Hi. There was a mistake that you made. Actually, the Second World War.
Many mistakes.
I agree with a lot of the things you say, but the America First Foundation, or whatever it was, with Charles Lundberg as their leading speaker.
Don.
It was very popular at the time, and it was sponsored, of course, by the Soviets and the Russian or the Nazis, who had wanted to keep us out of the war while they divided up the two continents. And of course, we helped the Soviets to the tune of $150 billion, which Stalin acknowledged helped them. In fact, without it, he said, we would have lost to the Germans. And, you know, the things that happened then, I think the revolution is ongoing. I think Mr. Putin, actually Vladimir means rule the world, by the way. I think it's going on today. I think there's a lot of pressure, revolutionary pressure at every level, and I've experienced some of it firsthand, but I just wanted to correct that one little kind of omission.
So the World War II thing. Thanks for that, Don.
Yeah, so thank you, Don. You're right to bring up America First. It's a fascinating movement in the 1930s. Charles Lindbergh is one of the individuals. Many major intellectual figures in the U.S. as well. Joseph Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father, is part of the America First movement. And as you say, they're individuals who are saying the United States should stay out of Europe's wars. But the America First movement, as you obviously know because you're clearly very well read, the America First movement dies off pretty quickly after December 7th, 1941.
Which is the email about Eric and Ashland wrote about. He said, my understanding is that the public was very opposed to entering World War II pre-Pearl Harbor,
and then it changes. And so what I was arguing was, obviously there's opposition to America getting involved in World War II before the fact. World War II is the only war where you don't see massive political opposition once we're in the war. But almost every other war, from the War of 1812 through the Iraq War we've just lived through, has had major opposition from American citizens during the war itself. That is a very American thing, and it would have been American for America First to do that as well. They just pretty much died off, for the most part, after December 7th, 1941.
We were talking about the money in politics and how many people do get depressed about that, and I wonder what kind of power you see developing either now or down the road in the Move to Amend movement, where we would amend the Constitution. We talked to the folks at Move to Amend a couple of times a few years ago, and I haven't talked to them much since because they don't seem to be very active. But
right.
A desire to change the Constitution so that corporations are not people and money is not speech.
Right. Well, I think there is growing frustration and recognition that this is a problem. Whether we'll get a constitutional amendment, I don't know. That's a hard road to hoe. But I do think there are a couple of things that could change very quickly. Even though you have lots of large donors or a handful of large donors, many Americans give money to causes. And what we found looking at this is actually many people give to causes and don't know what their causes actually support. People need to spend more time looking at what they're giving their money to. People give money to AARP. What does AARP really stand for? Does it match up with your ideals or not? And what the Obama campaign of 2008 proved was that you can raise a lot of money in small quantities from a lot of people. And that's really the way to counter this. Right now, you have a few big actors, the Sheldon Adelsons, the Koch brothers, and others, who dominate the political landscape in many respects.
I think they prefer to be called Koch, but
Koch brothers, excuse me, right. I grew up in New York City with Edward Koch, so I
get
them confused all the time, though very different politics. But the solution to this, and it's always the revolutionary solution to these changes, is a mass appeal to people to use their $10 and $20 and $30 and $100 donations in different ways. And in 2008, that made a huge difference in the presidential election. It can make a huge difference around many of these other issues. I would still support more legislation beyond that, but that's a way to start. How do we use our money? And let's think more clearly about that.
So small amounts of money, but in large numbers
exactly.
of people.
Got exactly.
It. All right, we've run out of time. I wish we had another hour with you. Jeremy Suri is the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin, speaking tonight at 7 at the Meese Auditorium on the Southern Oregon University campus in Ashland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Great show.
Been a pleasure.